wife and I attended our first large AA meeting, and it was at the Wichita State Convention. And the same speaker that is going to speak to us tonight kicked off the Friday night meeting there. I'll always feel a depth of gratitude to this man, because I've been sober about 8 months, and I had a lot of fears brought on through 35 years of drinking. But I was told by Dale, I guess, that I had to go to this convention. I found out a year later I didn't have to, but I went anyway. And it was sort of mixed emotions that I had driving up there. Of course, there was a feeling of excitement and curiosity. But mainly, they told me there were going to be 1,000 people there. Mainly, could I handle all those, you know, being around all those people? I was wondering if I was, you know, going to the right place. We found our way to the, you know, I thought maybe I was going to do a lot of things wrong. We got to the first meeting that night. That wasn't difficult. There were 1,000 people there, and it was an old small hotel. And this speaker who's going to address us tonight, he made me laugh. And he made me laugh until I cried. And I looked around, and I wasn't the only one that was laughing and crying. And I think I was crying all by myself, not knowing the reason why. But I think most of all, he let me know that I was in the right place at the right time, and I'm proud to introduce Buttermilk.
Thank you, Jack, for the wonderful introduction. It was beautiful. As I walked over here, I glanced down at the Father, had us in the prayer, and it reminded me of a little silly joke that I tell occasionally. And it seemed that this girl got on the bus and started to light a cigarette, stuffed a cigarette in her mouth, and she looked up and started to light it, and she didn't have a match. Looked up and there's a fella standing there in a dark suit. She said, "Fella, do you have a match?" "No," he said, "indeed I don't." And he said, "I'll tell you right now, young lady, I'd just as soon commit adultery as to smoke one of them things." She said, "Well, I would too, but I've just got 20 minutes off for lunch." Thank you. I'm Buttermilk Smith, and I'm an alcoholic. Hello, everybody. It's so good to be here. And before I get carried away with anything, I would like to thank Larry and the committee for inviting us up. It's always a privilege to come to Kansas City to anything. I've been here 2 or 3 times and always enjoyed it very much. Sorry, my wife Pauline couldn't come, but she's a little afraid of the weather. So I brought my bodyguard and come on. I always get carried away about these things, you know. That's what happened to them fingers. I wore them out of picking a banjo. Really, I never do know what to say when I get up here. But I don't think that'll have anything to do with how long I'm here. I have often tried to figure out why that I had to turn out to be an alcoholic. There was a whole multitude of us kids, and I'm the only one. And I've tried everywhere in the world to figure out why. I hate to just say I'm an alcoholic and not come up with nothing that caused it. I think it's why I know Joe that said his mother set him on the pot backwards is what caused him to be one. I don't believe that happened to me. But I grew up down here in the edge of Arkansas back during that Hoover boom. And if you think Lazarus was poor, you should have come down through there about that time. And the whole roll of preachers was thicker than the fiddlers. They were preaching in every schoolhouse and in brush arbors and everywhere, preaching the NRA and the Blue Eagle and the End of Time and what have you. And it kept me scared to death all the time. I didn't know what to believe. And it just got to be plumb pathetic. And I had a brother that got into this preaching. He didn't have but a second grade education. I don't know how he thought he could preach, but he did preach and done a pretty good job. And he said he kept seeing this vision of a morning when he looked to the east. And it said GPC, a big sign had loomed up. And he had seen that a number of mornings. And he got thinking that meant go preach Christ. So he put a Bible in a canvas sack and took off a preacher. After about 6 months, he hadn't saved a soul. And I told him, I said, Jim, that might have meant go plow corn. You're going to be all right, I see that. That's good. Thank you. Anyhow, he got to preaching, and that made it worse. And getting back to this why as an alcoholic, I might have figured it out. You know, I grew up down there wearing them dashboard overalls. Wore them until I was putting it on. And I got up about 14 or 15 years old in about the second grade. And for some reason, they bought me a pair of waist pants and a white shirt. I don't remember what the occasion was, but some neighbors lived on up above us about a half a mile, and they had a daughter about my age, and one about my brother's age, a year or two older. And the girls invited us up one Sunday to spend the day, and invited a bunch of other kids in. And I don't know why, but I wore these waist pants and that white shirt. We got up there, and there's a bunch of other kids around, and we got to running and playing hide and seek, and I'd go hide, and nobody'd ever haunt me. But it seemed like I put in most of the morning, I put in that shirt tail in. Every time I looked down, my shirt tail is out. And we played till noon, and they called us in for dinner, and set us up around this big table and had me sitting next to the girl, and everybody's teasing me anyway. And had this white tablecloth on the table. And I thought, now, I should say something. The old man first made some kind of an apology for not having too much to eat. And I thought I should say something. And I did. I said, well, it's more than I expect. And I got thinking that didn't sound as right, so I looked around and I said, well, I guess it's all you could afford. And things weren't getting any better. And I looked down and that tablecloth wadded up in my lap and I just crammed it under my belt thinking my shirt tail was out. And they passed the turnip greens. And I stuck a fork in them and just started twisting, and it kept getting bigger. And I'd twist back the other way, and I just laid it out in my plate. And I caught everybody not a-looking, just put that in my mouth and swallowed. And it all went down with one string. And I got a hold of a napkin and got a hold of that and pulled it over. And I had to go. And I took everything that woman owned with me. And that wasn't really easy to live down. But don't know if that's what caused it or not, but could have. Didn't help any, I tell you. Well, I stayed around down there in Arkansas till I got about grown. And wasn't doing any good. And I hitchhiked out of there. And I don't know why I put the hitch on it, I just hiked. And I made it over to Bartlesville, Oklahoma. 50 miles north of Tulsa there. And I got an old zinc smelter over there. And I got a job in that zinc smelter. I had an old humpback German boss, mean as a hornet. And he told me, he said, if you can do this work, he said, it pays $4.81 a day. And I said, well, Lord Jesus, you can consider it done. I never had heard of anybody making that kind of money. So I went to work, and I've always set goals and never did meet any, but I'm a great hand to set them. And I figured if I could stay there 3 years of making that kind of money, I could go back to Arkansas and build a better town than Cincinnati. That's where I come from. But it didn't work out. A lot of disappointments. I had an old bathhouse over there. About 400 of us took showers in there at the same time, if you please. And all my life I've been taught that all men were created equal. And they're not. But I went to work anyway. And my money wasn't accumulating like I thought it should. But that first payday I got, I bought me a suit of clothes, first one I'd ever had. And about the next one, I bought me a pair of them Bronx Stompers boots. And about the next payday, I bought me a Stetson hat. And then I think it was about the next payday, I discovered girls. And I got engaged to three of them at the same time. You talk about a hillbilly picking it off, I was off and running. But my money wasn't accumulating like I thought it should. I just wasn't getting ahead of any. And I wrote to this brother, the preacher, he was still down in Arkansas preaching, and told him how well I was doing. And he thought that'd be preaching, so he quit and come out. And he too got a job at the smelter, and he too got him a pair of boots and a hat. And we saved up a little money, and we bought a Model A Ford between us. And then we saved a little more money, and we went down in Arkansas to visit the folks. We drove around and visited, well, kin to everybody down there. Drove around and visited all of them, told them if you ever need anything, just write to us. We're doing good. But there was something that was bugging us. We had happened to pay 20 cents a pound for bacon out there around Bartlesville, and that was going again the grain, because we never had paid for any bacon. If we run out of meat, we just killed a hog. Didn't make any difference whose it was. They run outside anyway. So we was driving along there about as drunk as a couple of fellas should stay the year around, and run into a bunch of them old hogs. And we just jumped out and cornered this up one in the corner of a rail fence, about 120-pound coat, and threw him in the back seat of that A-motor and headed for Bartlesville. And we'd kind of forgot he was in there, you know. And we'd go along over there between Carr and Salina, between sundown and dark. And I leapt up, and there's one of them Holstein cars back there, and they're stopping everybody. And I looked at Jim, and I said, we might be in trouble. And then I looked back at that hog, and he's kind of got leaned up in the back seat like he's one of us. And I just pulled off my hat and put on the hog. And that patrolman walked up and threw that flashlight in my face, and he said, what's your name? I said, Buttermilk Smith. Threw it over on my brother, and he said, what's your name? He said, Jim Smith. Threw it back on that hog with my hat on and said, what's your name? I got that old hog with my thumbnail, and he said, Orange. Well, he said, go ahead, and he was walking back over to the car where this other patrolman was kind of shaking his head. And he said, I'll tell you right now, there's none of them Smiths very good looking. And he said, that old Orange, the ugliest damn man I ever seen in my life. Tend to hesitate to get up here and talk because I've had people to doubt some of the things that I do. It hurts, you know. But golly, I never did know much to do but tell stories. I stayed drunk telling them for 20 years, and I've stayed sober telling them about that long. And I don't know a whole lot about this old program, so I'm going to tell you about it, but it don't take me long to bed. And I just need to put in an hour up here telling you about this AA. It don't take me but a minute anyway. I don't know why I tell this. It's not a good story. I think I've just fell in love with the way I tell it. But I often tell about this. No, that ain't what I was going to tell, but it will, I guess. I often tell about the time I went to Fort Worth to the Fat Stock Show. All my life I'd wanted to go to that Fat Stock Show, and every time they'd have one, I was really too drunk to go or too broke to go. And I found out when they were having it, and I throwed a sober spell for about a couple of weeks, and saved up a little money, and just got on the bus and went to Fort Worth. Landed in Cowtown a day or two early, and got me a galleon of that sweet Lucille and started drinking it, and got me a room down there on Skid Row, and got me a galleon of sweet Lucille and started drinking it, and it seems like every time I'd try to talk to one of them Bronx stompers, he wanted to whip me. And some of them is getting the job done. They had my mouth, my both eyes closed, my front teeth knocked out, and I was in a heck of a mess. Staying down at this old Skid Row hotel, and that old girl that run it was just as kind as a mother's love, and so ugly she'd have to slip up on the dipper to get a drink of water. She was a kind old girl. I liked her, and she was good to me. She told me one day, she said, I don't believe these people like you. Well, I said, they haven't gone out of their way to show it in any way else to do. She said, if I was you, I'd leave. I said, well, I'm going to leave when I get to her and see how. I said, I'm not enjoying this like I thought I would. So she kept me around there for a week or two and put poultices on my eyes and fed me soup. And she'd give me a pipe and a pouch of tobacco. I'd sit around there and smoke that pipe. And I finally got quite to see pretty good. And I got my little suitcase and went down by the wine store and got me a bottle of wine or two and put in the suitcase. Went on down to the depot and bought a ticket to Amarillo. I thought I'll go out in West Texas and see if I can get along with them people any better. Train come in, I got on, walked about halfway down through a car, and found an empty seat, put my suitcase up, and sat down. And just as the train was pulling out of the station, in the door come a woman in a pair of shoe heels about that. Now they higher than that, they're that high. Walking right straight up and down, and had on a fur coat that was a shedding, and carrying a little old fuzzy dog she called Poo Poo. And sat down by me. And started chattering like a chipmunk. And Poo Poo growled at me. And I had about all that I could stand. And I got up and got my suitcase and took off down through the train. And I found an old club car. It was empty. And I found me a table next to the window and sat down, raised the window, lit my pipe, and took a drink of wine, and I thought, boy, this is going to be all right. I'm going to enjoy this trip. Lo and behold, it wasn't 5 minutes till the door flung open, and in come that woman with Poo Poo and sat down across from me. And about the first thing she said, you'll probably have to quit smoking that pipe. It might make Poo Poo sick. And I said, now, woman, if God don't think any more of you and Poo Poo than I do, you're both lost. And you should go on and peddle your paper somewhere else. I've got some serious drinking to do. Well, she just kept sitting there. Exactly, I laid my pipe down in the ashtray. When I did, she grabbed it and threw it out the window. Well, I just grabbed Poo Poo and threw him out the window. If you ever seen a woman come on cruise, she did. She called a conductor and a porter, and I'm not sure but what the engineer come back. I thought they was going to lynch me. And finally got that old conductor upset, and he said, now, if you people don't sit down and shut up, he said, I'm going to stop the train and put you both off. Well, she quieted down a little bit, and we got on into the next little old town, and I reckon everybody met the train, and the dock is full of people. And she was still wearing so much cane, he did put his clothes off. And she's running up the dock and telling them people, that savage man throwed my little dog off of the train. My little dog got there starving to death. And here come one of them harness cops that I love so well. He said, did you throw that woman's dog off the train? I said, indeed I did. And if you open your mouth again, I'm going to stick 200 pounds of fist in it. I said, that ain't none of your business. He looked at me a minute and said, I don't believe it is. At that time, she started jumping up and down. This old girl didn't hollering, Poo Poo, Poo Poo. And I looked up, and here come that dog up the railroad track with my pipe in his mouth. Thank you. As bad as them two old men I heard about in this one is telling the other, and he said, had on a new hearing aid. He said, you ought to get you one of these hearing aids. He said, it's the best one they make. And told about all them things they put in it that the astronauts use. He said, it's the best one they make. The other said to him, said, what kind is it? He said, it's about a quarter to four. This alcoholic who dreamed he died and went to heaven. And he got in there trying to get in and had a long line of people.
And he was back at the back of the line. All the people back there where he was had a face that long and looked like it. Oh, they looked bad. Wasn't very happy. Up at the gig where they're letting them in, every once in a while they'd hear the darnest bunch of clapping and cheering and carrying on. He looked over and there's a microphone hanging there. Picked up that mic and he said, "What's going on up there?" First thing come back over the mic and said, "They're not counting adultery."
Thing wrong with police work today, they know too much about it.
give me a club and a pistol and shook hands with me and said, it's all yours. Well, they did give me a book of the city ordinance, which I never did get time to read. Well, about the third night that I was on patrol, they started in to throw me out of the bar. And when the fight is over, I had the handles of a 38 Smith & Wesson left. The rest of it had wore out over their hage. Hage, I believe, is the word to use. And I went out and sat down by them and told them, I said, now, fellas, I brought a wife and baby and come up here, and I don't have the money to leave, and this is too small a town for all of us. So they left a few days later, and I stayed there for quite a while, 3 or 4 years, without any more problems other than just staying drunk all the time. And they didn't anybody criticize me for it, you know. They didn't pay no attention to me being drunk. I didn't have nothing to do anyway. Nobody ever stole anything. Now, I live in a town right now about the same size as Cordova. They've got a sheriff force there of about 4 or 5 men. There's 6 city policemen there. And they're busy all the time, just running here and doing it. I never did have nothing to do but drink. And I could do it well. I was a good hand at it. They never did get me in trouble about it. One night we had a turkey shoot there. Some gal sent outside and brought a bunch of live turkeys up there. And you'd be surprised if the 30, 40-year-old men that had never seen a turkey had a turkey shoot, and I've won 3 of them turkeys. We was living upstairs in the Lathrop apartment, and the carpets on the lobby was about that thick. And my wife had them turkeys tied up and given to me, and I was supposed to take them upstairs and back out on the back porch and put them in a crate. And I got in the lobby with them, and they got to flopping, and one of them got loose. Well, I wasn't too nimble on my feet. I couldn't catch it. And I debated a lot of things. I thought about shooting it, but I thought the bullet might ricochet and hurt somebody. Well, I finally reasoned it out that there's no use to leave one turkey down here by itself, so I just turned the other 2 loose with it. And went upstairs and went to bed, pistol, uniform, and all. Next day, that old landlady come up there about 10 o'clock. And she looked at me and she said, if you're not a fine-looking thing, she said, what I ought to do is have you arrested. I said, you can't have me arrested. I'm the chief of police, if you please. She said, well, there's another policeman here. I said, well, he's drunk. She said, well, what in hell do you think your problem is? And it cost me, I think, by the time I got the carpets and the rug clean and paid for what I spent on the turkeys, I had $75 apiece in them turkeys. And I run an ad in the paper, turkeys at half price. And then the old man run the dairy wouldn't give a damn to see a step ain't eat a bale of hay. And he come up and looked at him and he said, those are nice turkeys. What do you consider half price? I said, what about $37.50 a piece? I reckon he's still a running. He left there. But they never did say nothing about him teaching me or anything. I just stayed on. And finally quit that job and went back into construction business. That's what I went up there for in the first place. And I got acquainted with these 2 fellas. Well, I worked with them all the time. One of them's name was Malamute Slim. The other one was Slim Jensen. I'd like to kind of try to describe Malamute to you if I could. Ain't easy. He was about a hammer handle taller than I am and about half as big around. And he had one eye knocked plumb out. And he didn't wear a patch over it, he just had a hole in his head. In fact, a bunch of them totem poles had better looking heads on them than Malamute did. And Slim Jensen looked a lot like him, only he didn't have the hole in his head. And then there was me. And they often said the three of us made a good pair. And we drank all the time, day and night.
Worked too.
We worked all the time. But we drank. And when we thought that there wasn't nothing wrong with it, we thought everybody done it, you know. It's just way of life. And to kind of let you know the kind of humor Miley Moot had, we was at the Seward one time, and Miley Moot was a little drunk than he generally was. And he started out across the street, and here come an old cop down through there, flopping his wings, and run over him. And skinned him up pretty bad. We went and got him and tugged him up at this little clinic, and they had him in there on the table with two or three doctors and nurses working on him. I looked up, and here comes the girl up the hall that carries the pad and pencil and wants to know where was you born and why and all them things, you know. And the first thing she done, she tiptoed and looked over in there at Molly Moot, and she said, "Are you married?" He said, "Hell no, woman, a cop run over me." My drinking kept getting worse and worse. I got to having blackouts, and they'd last 3 or 4 days at a time. Things just kept getting worse. They didn't get any better. And then some of the things that I could tell about it, it don't sound reasonable that it could happen. Then one time Ross sent me, there may be some people here that know Ross McDonald. He come from over here to Manhattan, Kansas. And he was tougher than a boot heel, a little Scotch Irishman. And he sent me from Fairbanks one time to Great Falls, Montana, and from there back to Seattle to hire a crew of men. And I made the trip. And walked down and went in the office the next morning. Ross looked up at me with that bad eye, and he said, "Well, them men got in." I said, "What men?" He said, "Them you went after." Oh, I said, "Them men." And I never did remember leaving town, never have remembered it since, nothing about it, but I got the men and got them back. Went down one morning, started to getting ready to pour concrete. Ross come in and said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to pour that concrete." "Oh, hell," he said, "you poured it yesterday." I went and looked at it, and it was as good as I could have done any other time. But that ain't the bad part of it. You've heard these doctors say, you know, that the DTs will kill you in 10 days. I've heard that said. They won't. I had them for 3 years. And I knew what I had, but I didn't know what to do about it. I just knew I had it. And if I run out of whiskey and couldn't get a drink when I needed it, this white horse would come up. If I was in the truck, he'd get in the truck with me. If I was walking, he'd walk with me. If I was laying down, he'd lay down with me. And he'd talk to me, not talk to him. We've had some brilliant conversations. He never would take the bits out of his mouth. Slobbered a lot. Bugged the hell out of me, that slobbered yet. But who knows, I might have slobbered a little too, I don't know. But I'd had this horse a long time, kind of got to liking him. I didn't know there was anything I could do about it. And now I'm working, trying to make a living and trying to make a man a hand like that, you know. And one morning, Ross come out and got in the truck with me and opened the glove box and got the bottle out and took a drink. And then put it back in there. He didn't offer me a drink, and it's my whiskey. And he said, "Now, Buttermilk, if I open that one more time and find a fifth of whiskey in it, I'm going to have to run you off." And I thought about it a while, and I didn't want to run off, because I had a good job, and I needed a job. and I'm lost. If you're going to do it that way, we might as well do it today. Because if I'm in the truck, that bottle will be in there, because I can't operate without it. And I never forget the disgusted look that he had on his face when he looked at me. And he said, well, you ain't doing too good with it. And I said, that may be right, but I can't do without it. Never had heard they ate. Don't reckon there was any up in that country at that time. They was AA before that. And Ross told me, he said, now, if you'll quit, I'll pay your way to Tulsa. He said, if you keep on till I have to fire you, you're on your own. Because I was hired up there. They didn't hire me in the station to take me up there. I was hired up there. So he wasn't obligated to send me home, but he did. And he bought me a ticket, helped me get my clothes and tools together, bought me a ticket to Tulsa. And put me on an airplane. And I should have been in Tulsa in 24 hours. But it was 6 weeks it took me to get home. And I could write a book about it. If I could write, I could write a book about it, you know. About the parts of it I remember. And then there's a lot of it I don't remember. But mercy, mercy. The plane stopped in Great Falls. And I got off. For some reason, I don't know why, I just got off.
And there was a limousine there, and I figured he'd come after me. So I just got in it. And they went into town and parked in front of a big hotel. And when I got out of the limousine, I could hear old Tommy Duncan singing, "Get off at the end of the line." And I looked across the street, and there was a Coliseum or City Hall or something over there. And Bob Wells and his bunch was playing a dance. And I went over there. Don't remember a whole lot about going over there, but I remember going over there and talking to them a while. I don't know how many days later, I woke up in a hotel, and the old pantry is to look at your key, you know. And I looked at the key, and it said, give the name of the hotel in White Sulphur Springs, Montana. Now, dear ones, you can't take a million yards and get to White Sulphur Springs. I don't know how I got there, how come me there, but I was there. Well, I dressed and felt in my pocket, I had a few dollars, and went downstairs and got a drink. And went over and said, I'll talk to this desk clerk, maybe he can tell me something. And he called me Mr. Smith, and I liked that. And we talked for quite a while, and he didn't seem to think there was anything wrong. And I said, well, I've got to get out of this town. And I just started towards the door, and he said, well, just a minute. He said, don't you want your money? And I said, I'd forgot that. And he went and opened the safe and just handed me a handful of money. $400, $500, $600, I don't remember. There's a lot of money to hand a drunk. And I said, what's this for? Where'd I get it, I mean? He said, you mean you don't know? I said, no, if I did, I wouldn't ask you. Well, he said, you've been here for a week playing poker with them sheep herders back there. So that let me know where I got the money. I put it in my pocket and bought me a couple of jugs. And I said, where's the ad horse? And they laughed in my face. They said, they know such a thing. I said, well, where's the bus station? Said, ain't none of them either. Well, I said, how am I going to get out of here? Well, I said, probably the same way we got in, hitchhike. So I got my jug and took off. And I rode with every kind of a vehicle you can think of. One time, I caught a ride in a buggy with one of them Hitterites, they call them up there. They call them Mennonites in our part of the country. They're them fellas that wears the black hat and the beard and, you know, that preaching brother of mine used to call them fur-bearing Christians. I don't know why he got that. But I thought a ride was one of them in the buggy. And I'd gone without a drink so long that the horse had come up. My white horse was jogging along there with his horse. And he didn't know he was there. And I studied about as long as I could, and I said, "Fella, do you mind if I take a drink?" Well, he said, "Mind if you'll give me one?" So I gave him a drink and took one, and pretty soon we took another one. I looked at him and I said, "You don't think it's a sin to drink?" "Oh, no, no." He said, "It's a sin to buy the damn stuff." That dude was right, I don't know. Well, anyhow, 6 weeks later, I finally wound up in Martinsville. I was there and everything I owned. I broke and had on everything that I owned. And it was about income tax time. And I had a brother who was a little better educated than the rest of us, and he'd made out the income tax for the other four brothers. And I had him to make mine. And I had paid more income tax than either one of my brothers had made. And they was driving good cars and living in nice homes and wearing suits of clothes and getting along pretty good. And that kind of caused me to think that maybe I wasn't managing right. No, to be honest, I knew and had known for 2 or 3 years that I was in trouble with alcohol. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I was dreadfully afraid of being put in an institution. And I had just about decided my only way out was to drink till I died. And fear of those places kept me from asking for any help. I remember my brother and my first wife talked about sending me to Bonita. And man, it created a hell of a mess. It scared me to death. And I guess some of my brothers had called AA or got in touch with them. And this was 1951. And I was there at this preaching brother's house. He had come and got me. And he had quit stealing hogs and started preaching again. And he was radical about it. And he got a gallon of ice water and a Bible and 2 straight chairs, and we went out in the front yard and sat under a little tree. And he would read the Bible a while and preach to me. And I'd take a drink of that ice water and cook a while. And the hog horse was laying there and I couldn't talk to her. And it was just about the worst day I had ever spent. And I looked at Jim and I said, "If I don't get a drink, I'm going to die." Well, he said, "That's all right. I'm a preacher. I can take care of everything." Didn't bother him any, didn't he? But finally this little fella come up in a Jeep who was from AA. And he got out and come over there and he took one look at me and he said, "Fella, you're sick." And I said, "Well, that didn't take no genius to figure that out." "No," I said, "I guess not." And he looked at the preacher and he said, "Do you mind if I give him a drink? We'll have to have one." So he went and got a first question that walked back up and pitched it to me. And I went into one of them rivers and throwed it back out there in the yard. And thank God there wasn't any rocks. And he went and got it and twisted the head off of it and gave it to me. And I tried to get it out the way, and when it gets about there, my head would just hit the ground. And I couldn't connect. Oh, he said, "You are the man." So he set me down in the chair and got this preacher to hold me by the hair of the head. And he pulled about a page of that first horse down me. Well, the horse got up and left. He wouldn't stay around the drunk, that horse. And I began to come to that plum intelligent again, you know. And this little fella asked me if I'd consider joining Alcoholics Anonymous.
I said, I'll join the Ku Klux Klan if it'd just get people to leave me alone. Now, well, forgive how he looked at me. He said, you've just about accomplished that by yourself. And I had. But that was my first deal with AA. After that, I'd go to a meeting. I said, yes, I'll go to a meeting. So they got me cleaned up and not talk a while, too. I could tell a story about that, but I ain't got time. I'm running behind here. Got a light, said nothing about AA yet. And haven't got there yet, have it? Well, then it's easy for me to watch somebody. And it was 6-7 miles I had to come to get help. And he got me cleaned up, and he come and got me and took me to a meeting that night. And so many people say I don't remember the first meeting. It seemed like when I'd come out of one of them blackouts, I was smarter than I ever was. I remember the meeting, I remember everybody was there, and I thank Clinton for everything that it said. I remember the speaker as well as if it was yesterday. And he was a tall, fine-looking young man, many inches down young now. Had on a plaid suit, walked up to that podium, and he said, I'm Clancy Loveless, and I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, yeah, and I might be too, but I ain't going to be bragging about it. And Clancy still lived there around about 40 miles of him. We're still buddies. Everybody there come to me and shook my hand and told me I was in the right place. And they started to take me home. And I got about halfway back out to those places, and one of these fellas said, have you ever had the BP? Oh, I said, no, I probably drank that too much, but nothing like that. And then it dawned on me, they're taking me back to that creature. So I told them about this horse. Well, they said, that's better good. I knew that was bad, didn't I, Kevin? They said, now, if you want to sober up, we're going to help you sober up. And we ain't going to do this, and we ain't going to do that, and we ain't. They said that to them many times. I got to wondering if there was anything they would do. But the final said, we'll help you sober up if you want to sober up. And I did, and I so told them I did. And they put me to bed on a cot on my brother's back porch. And there were two of them fellas stayed with me around the clock. If they had to go to work, another one come. For almost a month, day and night, they stayed with me. They never mentioned a doctor or a hospital. I reckon they didn't know you could. And I don't remember them giving me a drink after that first day. But they might have, I don't know. Finally, the horse left and stayed gone. And one night, the room got full of snakes. There were thousands of them. There wasn't none of them poison snakes. I wasn't afraid of them. There was just a multitude of them. One of them had on glasses, bad girl, I don't know. I wasn't really afraid of him, I just didn't like his look. And that's the way they dragged me out, it sobered me up. And it was wonderful. And I wish that I could stand here in the presence of God and all you people and say that that was my last drunk. But it wasn't. I was sick and hard up as I was and everything. I stayed sober 3 months, I think. And golly, we were having a ball. We were going to meetings. We were going to Kansas City to get to read the Lord's Prayer. I mean, we were going in a blowing. But I never had read the book, and they didn't really anybody push it on me. They told me I should, but I didn't get excited about it. I was just sober, and I started associating with these people, and everything's all I need. And we got to going out of town and making talks and having fun, and no day up the road there had a drive-in place, and he made hot donuts. We'd go up there about twice a week, and he knew when we'd be there, and he'd pull out two or three trays of them hot donuts, and pass them around and say, eat them, they've got sugar in them, they'll take the pulse of that alcohol. And we were just eating them sunglasses going out of style. And I've been so for near a year before it dawned on me that he wasn't nothing but a damn donut salesman. But he was good at it. Anyhow, by not doing the things that we're supposed to do, I wound up drunk. And I stayed drunk off and on for 10 years. And every time I'd get sober, I'd go back there and I'd sit on that front row and look up at that speaker with face most hair in a cellar glass, expecting him to tell me how to stay sober. And I guess he told me 10,000 times. But I guess it wasn't the answer I was looking for. It didn't do no good. And I could stay sober on willpower, if you like that word, I don't. For sometimes 6 months I'd get. And then boom, something would come along and I'd be drunk for 6 months. Back to the hospital, jail or somewhere. Never was contented in them jails. And I made it back to Bartlesville. And I went to see one of them old boys that set up with me. I didn't like him. He was a little hard-headed Republican. And we didn't get along too good. But I liked his brand of sobriety. And I went to see him. And he didn't seem to be too glad to see me. And he called me a lot of things besides buttermilk. But he said, I'm going to tell you one more time about this thing. Now, he said, if you read the book, it tells you in there very plainly that no human power can relieve our alcoholism, that God could and would be assault. Now, he said, if I was you, I'd go down here under the bridge or in the park or wherever you're sleeping and go down by a bridge abutment and see if you can't come to an agreement on how to quit this drinking. Well, I'd heard that from this podium, I guess, 1,000 times, but it didn't register. And praying was nothing new to me. God, I learned to pray when I was killed. I fell off the swamp boat down the Gulf of Mexico one time. And when I come up and got that salt water blowed out of my nose, I said, God, help me out of this fog pond. I didn't send for the group. I didn't think I'd get there in time. And there was a light bulb up on the mast burning. I didn't say nothing about it either. I went straight to the horse's head. I wanted him to hear me. And I guess he did. 3 hours later, I got out. So praying when nothing new, I'd prayed to quit drinking thousands of times. Or to get out of jail or what have you. But I left and I went back out to this same cock where I'd sobered up 10 years prior to that. Now, I had about 3 miles to walk and I done a lot of thinking. And when I got there, I just pulled off my clothes and I knelt down by the side of that cot on my knees on that concrete floor. And I prayed all night. But I never did mention quit drinking. This time I didn't pray to quit drinking. I prayed all night to God to remove the compulsion to drink. But I knew if I couldn't quit wanting to drink, I couldn't quit drinking. Because the compulsion to drink was stronger than I was, and it was with me all the time. And to tell you how bad it was, I could be thumbing through a magazine during my dry days and see a picture of a bottle. And I'd get slobbering until I couldn't talk, just looking at the picture of a bottle of whiskey. That's how bad I was hooked. I prayed all night for the compulsion to drink, to leave. And Franklin Williams could take this and make something out of it that it would be beautiful. But I've tried to, so help me. I've tried to build this into something real big. I can't. I wanted to say the lightning flashed and the bells rang and all that stuff. It didn't happen that way. But when I stood up on the floor the next morning, I knew I no longer had to drink. If I didn't want to, because at that time I didn't want to drink. And that's been a little over 21 years, and I haven't had to drink since because I haven't had a compulsion to drink. Now that was one of these miracles that we talk about. And sometimes I'm hesitant to tell that amongst new people for fear they'll all expect that's happened to them, and it may not. And the book says we do it one day at a time, and I don't argue with the book. That's the only way that I could have done it, and God knew that, so he helped me out in that way. Now I'm not drinking, but I've still got a living problem, and it's kind of bad, you know. I've been off up in that north country with a bunch of construction stiffs, and most of them drunks, and I had to start in to try to live again in this world with these people. And that's got to be a problem. And to cap it all off, I'd been single about 15 years, and then I'd just barely been sober 2 years, and I got married again. And I called that on. And I'd be out in the yard doing something, and I'd have to go to town to get something. I'd just jump in the car and go get it. Come back, she'd say, "Where you been?" I said, "Been uptown." "Why didn't you tell me?" I said, "Didn't I have supposed to?" "Why didn't you kiss me goodbye?" "I didn't know I was supposed to." "You didn't tell me you loved me." I said, "Well, I told you I loved you when I married you. If I told you my mind, I'd tell you." It got sticky, I tell you. And it kept bugging me about this kissing goodbye. And I was fixing to go somewhere there one day, and we had a big old cowboy with hung grapes, and my wife looked just like Porter Wagner. And they got me so upset, I went over and kissed that old boy. You think he didn't look funny? Now, I think I'm out of time. I don't know how long I started, but told you I was going to tell you about this AA, and I am. If you knew it, Miss Colvin, first thing you ought to do is get your sponsor. And the next thing you ought to do is get your big book, and you ought to start reading it. And you ought to go in every meeting that you can. And you ought to use that sponsor every chance you get. And then, next, you better find your power greater than yourself. And I'd suggest that you call in God. And attend those meetings, use that sponsor, and read that big book. And I guarantee you, you'll stay sober, because that's about what this program amounts to. And you see, it didn't take me an hour to explain it. It took a few minutes, but that's about all I know to say about it. That's what it works for me. I'm awful glad it got to come up, and it don't make a lot of difference what you people think of me, but whether you love me or not, but for God's sake, don't shut me out. Permit me to love you, and I'll be all right. And I thank you for coming. God bless you, and I love you.